This spring, if you'd rather spend time enjoying your lawn instead of trying to keep it alive, there's good news. TruGreen is the easiest and most affordable way to get a beautiful lawn. All you have to do is water and mow, and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and even some things you might not even think of. They'll do all of it, while you can do literally anything else. With True Green, you could have your lawn looking as good as a putting green. That's not hyperbole. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. True Green offers a satisfaction guarantee, and they have a verified best price promise, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people guaranteed.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside. Repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
This is Intelligence Matters with former acting director of the CIA, Michael Morrell. Brought to you by Lockheed Martin. Your mission is ours.
We'd been worried about Al-Qaeda as a group back to the middle of the previous decade as they grew. While I was still in CTC, the creation of virtual stations to manage the effort against Al-Qaeda, I think, was the beginning of a large and growing effort. It was by far the largest effort for the center, not as large as the effort that we devoted to some nation-state issues. That changed after 9/11. It was a big effort, but not the most substantial one. After 9/11, that changed.
This is the third in a series of episodes we are producing to commemorate the 20th anniversary of 9/11. In this series, we are interviewing a number of people about where they were, what they did, and what they saw on 9/11. Our guest today is Winston Wiley, a career CIA officer who on 9/11 was CIA's Deputy Director of Intelligence, the person in charge of all the agency's analysis. We'll be right back with that discussion after a word from our sponsor. I'm Michael Morrell, and this is an episode in a special series of Intelligence Matters, Remembering 9/11.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Winston, welcome to Intelligence Matters. It is very good to have you on the show. And much more important than that, it is very good to talk with you again.
Good to talk to you.
So, Winston, given that we have so many currently serving intelligence officers who are listeners of the podcast, I wanted to mention, before we talk about 9/11, one thing that perhaps you don't know, or perhaps you do know, but you had a significant impact on me and on my career. And one thing in particular comes to mind to me, which is you gave me a piece of advice once about career management that not only turned out to be true for me, but turned out to be something that I would repeat over and over again to officers who worked for me. And I don't know if you remember that or not. We were on a trip together to Hawaii, and I had just given some horrible advice to career advice to an officer who worked for me. And in mentoring me, you told me that assignments, job assignments outside the chain of command, the ones that take you away from just being focused on the next step in the management ladder, are the ones that really matter in a career and are the ones that actually build the breadth that one needs to be a senior officer, and that are the jobs you'll actually remember, you know, in retirement someday. And I don't know if you remember that, but I really took that to heart, right? And for me, that became being George Tenet's executive assistant, running the PDB staff, briefing the president, serving overseas. And I just wanted to let you know and to let all my listeners know who are thinking about how to manage your career that that advice was incredibly important to me and I think should be important to them.
Oh, well, thank you for remembering that. I don't remember it in as much detail as you just made it. It's consistent with what I believe and what I tried to do. Sometimes that's misinterpreted as careerism or jumping from place to place. I saw it as an opportunity to get spread across the range of activities that our agency afforded us and a job to do, a chance to do that better. So my time in CTC and then coming back to be ADDI and then ADCI for Homeland Security, you know, was kind of true to that. And I tried to share that with as many people as possible, and I'm glad you found it useful.
I listened. I actually listened. So this is a great transition, Winston, you know, because there's so many young officers who listen to the podcast and because there's so many students who listen to the podcast and who are thinking about their future career trajectory. Before we talk about 9/11 the day, I'd love if you could give us a kind of a synopsis of your career up to 9/11. We'll talk about your career after 9/11 later. But if you could share, you know, how did you end up at the agency and what different jobs did you have there leading up to 9/11? That'd be terrific.
Well, you know, how did I wind up at the agency is pretty easy. I was born into it. My dad was not in OSS, but was a charter member of CIA when it was formed in 1947. And it's about the time I was born, too. Rush forward, you know, up into college years. I went to American University and took a part-time job that exposed me to clerical and helpful work, but you know, kind of made me part of the family. I then went into the service and came back in 1972 and went into the career training program, frankly anticipating that I'd have a career in operations. But I found my interim assignments in the Directorate of Intelligence immediately fascinating and impactful, and signed on to be an analyst in the old Office of Current Intelligence. That morphed into the new structure that the agency took on, the Director of Intelligence took on in the late 70s. And by 1980, I found myself in the Office of Near East and South Asian Analysis as Research Director and as Executive Officer, among others, for the great late Bob Ames and Helene Boettner. Worked for them until 1985 or so. I went to the Office of Global Issues as a deputy to Dave Carey, who later became executive director of the agency. I worked for Dave four or five times and got my first division assignment running the International Issues Division in OGI. Did that for 5 years, was asked to take a tour on the IG staff for a year, came back to that in 1990 to work for Bob Layton in the Office of Near East South Asian Analysis as head of the Persian Gulf Division. And that's where I was when, on the day Saddam invaded Kuwait in 1991. Worked through 1992 on running Persian Gulf Division, and found it time to look for another job after 5 years in NISA, and was asked to become the deputy in the Counterterrorism Center. The center was the first of those having explicit leadership teams of a senior ops officer and a senior analyst, and I got to work with Steve R. as his deputy for 2 years. Steve moved up to be chief of the NE division, and I took over as chief of CTC, brought on a very capable deputy from the ops side. So we continued the tradition of having one ops, one intel. Just in this case, we reversed the order and spent 5 years building a program. It's hard to imagine how small the counterterrorism effort was in the early 1990s and how it grew through the 90s, but only exploded after 9/11. Which is where I found myself then as Associate Deputy Director for Intelligence.
So, Winston, you were the Deputy Director for Intelligence. You were in charge of all the analysts. You were the agency's senior analyst on 9/11. Can you just very briefly explain to people what is that job and what was a typical day like for you?
Well, the Deputy Director for Intelligence, as it was called at that time, is responsible for organizing and producing the intelligence product that the director, that the agency puts out. We write the first draft and put to bed the president's daily brief, or most of the drafting for long-term analysis, and a heavy part of the load in doing national estimates and both drafting and coordinating those. In the counterterrorism arena, we had a substantial but not huge analytic presence embedded in the counterterrorism center to do traditional analytic work, as well as a cadre of analysts doing targeting and other operational support work, bringing the tradecraft that they had developed in the DI. And my job, along with my two immediate deputies, was to make sure that we got the right resources to the right people and valued the product and maintained its quality. In fact, tried to grow it as much as possible.
Winston, given the jobs you had, particularly your time in CTC, and then, of course, you couldn't ignore it as Deputy Director for Intelligence, Al-Qaeda was a focus of yours, I know. And I'm just wondering sort of how worried were you about the group in general prior to 9/11, and how worried were you in particular that summer, given all the warnings that we had in the spring and early summer? How were you thinking about that?
Well, we'd been worried about Al-Qaeda as a group, you know, back to the middle of the previous decade, as they grew, the creation. While I was still in CTC, the creation of virtual stations to manage the effort against Al Qaeda, I think, was the beginning of a large and growing effort. With almost every passing season, we used the analytic presentations of the directorate to push on the leadership both the size, the scope, and the potential significance of Al-Qaeda as a group. We tried to do everything we could to add resources, both analytical and operational, to that effort. It was by far the largest effort for the center, and yet not as large as the effort that we devoted to some nation-state issues. That changed after 9/11, but it was a big effort, but not the most substantial one. After 9/11, that changed.
Okay, Winston, can you walk us through the day of 9/11 for you? I know you did not plan to come to work that day. Can you walk us through it for us?
Indeed. The morning of 9/11 found me at BW Airport, putting my youngest daughter on an airplane at 9 o'clock in the morning on her way to California, only because she was taking her cat with her. Did she not take an earlier flight that would have had her in the air over the United States as the attacks were going on? Well, I'll never forget the phone call I got as I was parking the car from my secretary, letting me know that there had been, you know, first one, and as we spoke, a second crash into the World Trade Center. I sensed immediately the the dramatic changes that that would put on us as a nation, let alone as an agency or us as individuals.
So I suppose you knew immediately that this was terrorism?
Yes, I knew it in my bones. It didn't require me to sit down and ponder. Well, you know, a single incident into the tower, perhaps an accident. A second, no, you know, I can't imagine that anybody thought otherwise.
And immediately, Al Qaeda?
It would have to have been at the top of the list. There are only a few. A coordinated attack at the first two, and then it didn't take that long to realize that there were more planes aloft that represented a threat with the attack on the Pentagon, and later understanding what happened at Shanksburg. There just weren't very many groups that could muster the resources, the training, the tradecraft to be able to do that.
So what happened at the airport as the word started to spread?
Surprisingly, very little. When I went from the parking lot into the building, the local television sets were showing smoke coming out of the buildings, but they were continuing to process tickets for people to go into the waiting areas. And in fact, trying to go find my wife and daughter who were at the gate at that point, I was directed towards a security guy who told me I needed a gate ticket, which turned out to be, I went back to the desk and turned out to be a simple ticket stub with the words gate ticket written on it in hand. Unimaginable difference in level of airport security in those days compared to what happened in the immediate aftermath or, you know, even this afternoon, if you were to go back out to BWI.
And did you got to the gate and did you put your daughter on that flight or did you say?
I got to the gate and at the same, as I had told them, you know, you guys aren't flying today. The word had come out that the airport was being shut down and all flights were canceled. And so, you know, it wasn't there. It was, I was pushing against an open door.
And you took them home and did you come to work then?
Well, I took them home, but you can imagine what the traffic was like on, we went over to 95 to try to take them home. And that was just a solid jam. I turned around and went to the Baltimore Washington Parkway and took that down, took the, you know, a lifetime of living in the Washington area, back roads to get to places. And all along the way, there were fire trucks, you know, overtaking me, coming from lower Pennsylvania, Delaware, other places like that, heading towards the Pentagon fire, and I guess to be on site. Took me probably 3 hours, 4 hours to get back home. And then back over to the agency where I rejoined my deputies and George and others. I was in touch by phone. The team knew very well what to do. If nothing else, I mean, you probably remember that there'd been a fire a few months before that had forced us to look at how we dealt with emergencies. And the team, and we'd actually set up an alternate site to work on campus, and the team fell back on that, and you know, we were able to both produce intelligence and provide support. I think we took pretty good care of supporting the director during that period. I'll leave it to him to decide.
We're going to take a quick break to hear from our sponsor, and we'll be right back with more of a discussion with Winston Wiley.
We all have busy lives these days, and we don't want to waste a day recovering after a night out. That's why ZBiotics is the answer we've all been looking for. Their probiotic was invented by PhD scientists to tackle rough mornings after drinking. Here's how it works. When you drink, alcohol gets converted into a toxic byproduct in the gut. It's this byproduct, not dehydration, that's to blame for your rough next day. Pre-alcohol produces an enzyme to break this byproduct down, This is a proactive solution that wards off feeling miserable the next day instead of a reactive approach like drinking electrolytes or eating greasy food. Enhance your mornings with ZBiotics. Go to ZBiotics.com/CBS to get 15% off your first order when you use code CBS at checkout. ZBiotics is backed with a 100% money-back guarantee. So if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money, no questions asked. Remember to head to ZBiotics.com/CBS and use the code CBS at checkout for 15% off. Thank you, ZBiotics, for sponsoring this episode and our good times.
So, Winston, in the days immediately after 9/11, what were you focused on? What were the kind of things you had to do?
I'd say in the it was, you know, part of the overall effort that was led by the director to make sure that we responded in as thorough and aggressive a way as we could. That what that meant principally, you know, from my point of view, was what could we do to quickly create more analytic capability focused exclusively on Al-Qaeda and its supporters. We had been undertaking a review of what our structure and resources were, led by Marty. And the that provided us the raw material to look at a pretty granular fashion what we were doing and how many of us were doing that for each account in the directorate. My almost immediate conclusion was that we needed to double and redouble what we were doing and providing CTC analytic firepower. And I remember thinking that better to overshoot than to undershoot in responding to that. And we put together a plan, I think within a week, to make the largest reallocation of resources in the directorate's history. We basically took, you know, a chunk out of every office and resubordinated them to CTC and created an Office of Terrorism Analysis, in a fully capable standalone office, you know, embedded in the Counterterrorism Center. So,
in fact, you moved, I think, a couple hundred, if not 300 analysts.
I was dodging the, yeah. I was avoiding naming numbers.
Yeah. And I remember entire teams, right? Teams working on one issue or another were grabbed in whole and taken.
Well, that was my my strategy there was that rather than grab X hundred people at random and move them, that we move branch units with their leadership as one. So they would continue. They wouldn't physically move. They would just be resubordinated. Ask the office directors to figure out, you know, which branches that ought to be. And I gave them target numbers. And I said, pull one or two people back, hold one or two people back to continue to do the work on the original target countries. And then directed, you know, moved a very senior and experienced officer to take over the Office of Terrorism Analysis and to build a structure out of that. But the idea, but essentially, we moved units as a whole with their branch chiefs and, in some cases, I think, more senior officers, so that, you know, they were used to working with each other, they were used to their leadership, and tried to make that transition as seamless as possible. There were a few people startled by this, but there was more even excitement at the possibility of weighing in the immediate aftermath of this crisis than there was resistance.
Yeah, one of the other things that you had to do was to help the FBI stand up its new analytic capability. The president was asking much more of the Bureau than had been asked previously, and they turned to CIA for help, and you provided it.
Well, yeah, I'd been able to develop a pretty good relationship with the FBI counterterrorism folks during my time in CTC. We'd even gone as far as swapping deputies for a while. You know, they did in fact come looking for help. It was frankly a heavier lift to get people to go down to the bureau to work as analysts. That was not seen as being directly helpful as moving to CTC. But we did in the end find a dozen or so folks that went down and helped them set up their first analytic capabilities. It's hard to build a structure from next to nothing, and the analytic culture and the analytic focus that our friends in the bureau had been completely different than our experience was. So it was, they needed manpower, they needed some advice, and we had to try to make it not appear as if, you know, we were the pros from Dover coming into telling them how to do their business.
Yeah, and then I think one of the probably, you know, biggest issues we had post 9/11, as you well know, was a deep concern about follow-on attacks, which I think a lot of people really don't understand the degree of concern we had. Can you talk about that a little bit?
When you asked earlier what we were doing, you know, day to day, I mean, we had always tried to be focused on the latest threats and conscious of the fact that, you know, we needed to go deeper. We built analytic structures, a threat matrix, and teams of analysts so that every single threat report that we got, no matter how apparently far-fetched, would be chased to ground. Many, 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 many of these were probably without basis, but we had no ability to be confident of that short of doing the work. And I think that one of the big changes after 9/11 is that nothing was dismissed as being too small a probability, but that is a labor-intensive task.
So sometime after 9/11, George Tenet, the director of Central Intelligence at the time, asked you to take on a new senior assignment to create a new position. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yes. In June of the following year, the director asked if I would stand up a position called the Associate Director for Homeland Security. By then, the White House decided that there would be a full-time department, cabinet-level Department of Homeland Security, and wanted to make sure that there was the same kind of focus on supporting the creation of that department under Governor Ridge as there would be on any other major intelligence issue. As ADCI, he asked that not that I assume line responsibility for the support to Governor Ridge and the Department of Homeland Security, but that I use the background and knowledge that I had in the intelligence community and my relationships across the community to bring what we could to that effort. I added one deputy from the ops director at CIA, another deputy from NSA, one from DIA, and one from NSA. And we could and did react by being able to reach straight to leadership in those departments to make sure that new intelligence, new threat warnings, a decision to reallocate resources in the direction of one area or the other could be done seamlessly and help the director manage his community responsibilities. At the time, the DCI had both CIA and community responsibilities, which is not the organization that exists at this point. And so the ADCI job was a when the creation of, with the creation of TTIC and NCTC, those responsibilities more naturally fell on the community side. I think even you worked in that environment for a while.
We're going to take another quick break. We'll be right back with more Intelligence Matters. I'm Michael Morrell.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
So Winston, maybe kind of jump around here, kind of big picture a little bit. You were retired when the U.S. government brought Osama bin Laden to justice on May 1st, 2011. What was your reaction when you heard that?
Just, you know, when they broke into the broadcast, whatever I was watching, there was really only one thing I could imagine would bring the president to the news. And, you know, I watched the words form on his lips and could not have been more elated.
And then I want you to compare it to something else. I want you to compare it to the bringing of Mira Malakazi to justice. I think you were at Dulles Airport along with Director Tenet when the FBI returned him to the United States from Pakistan. And maybe before you tell us how you reacted to that moment, maybe you could just tell our listeners a word about who he was and why you were there.
Well, Mira Malakazi was the shooter in an incident that occurred on January 6th of 1993, right in the beginning of the Clinton administration, where he shot and killed two of our fellow officers and wounded another three. That began, at the time, I was the relatively new deputy director in CTC. And that, needless to say, became a leading target for our work. And I was in CTC for 5 years after that. And every night before I left, I got an update on where we were in a worldwide hunt for Mira Malakazi. Without going into the particulars of how he was found and brought back, the day did come in 1997 when the FBI was able to seize control and were able to have him not extradited but rendered back to the United States to be turned over to Virginia law enforcement and presented in courts here. I was asked, along with many others, if I wanted to go out to the airport to see him come in. I would not have missed it. I wanted the chance to see face to face somebody that had caused so much pain in the agency and had killed our fellow officers. I saw him march by on the arms of Brad Garrett, the lead FBI officer for the entire 5 years. Great officer. He remains active in pursuing criminals and other murderers. But Brad marched him from the Air Force plane that brought him into Dulles Airport. Dulles Airport, because it was in Virginia and in the same Fairfax County district that the crime was committed in, over to the helicopter that took him to the prison pursued the trial. You know, now that you ask it, you know, what was my reaction? It wasn't it wasn't elation at all. It was, you know, just, you know, disgust more than anything else when I saw what a weaselly little character he was.
Winston, I wouldn't be doing my job if I didn't ask the following question here, and you can choose to answer it how you want, of course. We're taping this the day after Kabul has fallen to the Taliban, and the war in Afghanistan is over, and the Taliban won. And I just love your reaction to what happened yesterday.
Michael, it's too soon. I've been, you know, I've been gnashing my teeth and listening to my stomach juices growl all morning long. It's a historical moment. It will change us. I hope not in a completely risk averse way, but we've got to get smarter at what we do in events like this. It's a tragedy.
Winston, maybe just one more question, and I wasn't even planning on asking it, but earlier you talked about Bob Ames, and you talked about working for him when he was running the Near East South Asia office. And I would bet most of my listeners don't know about Bob, and I was hoping you may could take a couple minutes and talk about him and what happened.
Bob Ames was, you know, one of the leading ops officers in the Middle East. There's a forgetting the title of the book that was written by Kai Bird about him, The Perfect Spy by Kai Bird. To all of your listeners, you know, who are at all interested in understanding an important part of agency history, that book is absolutely to be read. Bob was all, in addition to his skills as an officer and contacts as an operations officer, he was one of the most carefully read and analytical people I've met. He served as the National Intelligence Officer for the Middle East, and Director Casey asked him to take over NISA. And one of the very few people that I recall having served as both the director of a DI office and in as senior a position. As Kai Bird's book lays out, he was on a trip to Lebanon and was in the embassy when it was destroyed in a bombing that killed Bob and more than a half dozen other agency officers as well as other people in the building. His loss was huge. He was still a young man. I think he had the potential and vision and leadership to have risen to the top of the agency, and we lost him at far too young an age.
Winston, thank you so much for spending time with us today. That was Winston Wiley, and this was a special episode of Intelligence Matters, Remembering 9/11. Please join us next week for another episode.
Intelligence Matters is sponsored by Lockheed Martin. Your mission is ours. This show is produced by Olivia Gassis, Jamie Benson, Jake Rosen, Paulina Smolinski, and Ashley Armstrong. For more from this week's show, visit cbsnews.com. Intelligence Matters is a production of CBS Audio.
Are you ready for an all-new season of Survivor? You better be, because Survivor 46 is here, and it's 90 minutes of twists and turns you don't want to miss. Better yet, after each episode, there's a brand new episode of On Fire, the only official Survivor podcast. Each week, we go behind the scenes of the episode's biggest moments, taking you into the how and the why things happened. And this season, we're very lucky to be joined by an expert, the winner of Survivor 45, Dee Valladares.
What is up? I'm thrilled to be joining this team and to be giving you my take on how and the why players made the moves they did, what it takes to outwit, outplay, and outlast, and to ask Jeff some questions, because even after 26 days out there, there is still a lot for me to uncover.
Bring it, D. Listen to On Fire, the official Survivor podcast, wherever you get your podcasts.